From the Quackalope Network headquarters, this is the Weekly Quack with Board Game Co., your ultimate source for what's happening around the board game pond. In this week's installment, we break down deluxification in our hobby, discuss the new Rococo, and consider a potential Quackalope sitcom spinoff.
Hey, everybody, and welcome to the Weekly Quack. I'm your host, Jam, because in with me is, drumroll please, Alexander, Let's Be Frank, Buzzkill, the Muskrat, Sender, Rackle, the Thunder from North Hunter, Shadow Point 63, more, blah, 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 damn it, I couldn't finish it, ASR3.
Yeah, probably the worst attempt at saying his name you've had so
there
far.
There was a comment last week saying that we should cut off some section
Jackson
of the name.
Jackson Harris. And just, I think it's got
to
happen.
Yeah, get rid of Jackson Harris and just reduce it from ASR3 to ASMR3.
I know, I think it was just ASMR. Just
my parents always wanted to name me Madeline.
Just go like this and talk very, very seductively to the microphone. That should be your stick now, Alex. And Jesse Anderson, how are you guys doing today?
I'm doing good. Oh, wait, sorry. Let me do this again. I'm doing good.
Alex, you're doing great so far. I think people are really going to dig it.
If anyone doesn't know what ASMR is, it's just a really creepy start to a board game podcast, which I'm okay with, honestly. I am totally speaking. And speaking of which, thank you so much for joining us on today's very, very interesting show. And for those of you who are new to the Weekly Quack, welcome aboard this entirely interesting show. This is a board game variety podcast, and I say variety, I mean variety, organized into three main segments, none of which have anything to do with its ASMR or long names. Instead, it's going to be Shelf or Sell, where we debate whether to keep or get rid of games, the Medley Minute, where we talk about, well, anything really, and then On the Radar, which is going to be where we discuss upcoming games, Kickstarters, all those other things that we're excited about, and all that. And at the end of the show, when you're done, you know, with the ASMR clickety-clacketing and all that, make sure to head on over to Apple Podcasts, where you can leave a 5-star rating or wherever you get your podcasts from. And with that, Jesse, you're having so much fun, Jesse.
He just keeps bringing in more objects. Where do you have all these? Just have everything laying about? My lord.
And so with that, Jesse, what are you bringing to Shelf or Sell?
I'm probably bringing in one of the most tactical and ASMR-driven board games in this entire industry.
Oh, wow. Those are some bold words.
Have you ever thought to yourself, while walking by a forest stream, look at those beautiful rocks, the pebbles all spread out, glistening in the noonday sunlight, yeah, and little bits of driftwood floating down the dock? Well, if you happened to throw together a, you know, odd mix of rules and grab yourself some river rocks, you yourself could play this game. I'm bringing in a game by Smirk and Laughter called Shobu. This is going to be a game that came out about a year and a half ago, and it is a abstract game that is literally built off of the components that I mentioned. It has beautiful, I have seen some people dye and stain this beautiful wood that has rivets cut into it, and then it has a pile of river rocks. And throughout the course of the game, you're going to be pushing across four different locations or four different regions in a very abstract, shifting puzzle. The object of the game is to knock your opponent's river rocks off of some platforms while keeping yours on. The trick is that whatever you do on one side of the board is going to be replicated on the other, meaning that your movement is always paired with two stones at the same time, and the consequences of that become more and more dire and complicated as you play the game. This is going to be a game that fits very much into that old school abstract, chess, checkers, Othello, that feeling of sort of, you know, a historic game that you might have played when you were younger or when your grandparents were growing up. It feels like it ages, or it feels like it has been around for a long time, but it was just invented just a little while ago. Are you both familiar with this title?
Yeah, this is Shobu. I've had it in my collection for quite some time.
And yes, I remember us playing this back when we first got it. So I feel like I have an unfair advantage here. But with that said, it has been almost an entire year since we last played this.
It's been a year and a half.
So
it's been a year and a half. And both of you would probably know, and the audience would probably know, I was a big fan of this a year and a half ago when it first came out. I spoke very highly of this game.
Interesting.
He's trying to trick us, Alex. He's trying to trick us.
I think he's trying to trick us. Because here's the thing with Shobu. Shobu is delightfully visually appealing. Everything about the game, to me, screams like the kind of game that would appeal to Jesse's... appeal to his sensibilities or something along those lines. Even if the game weren't that good, I think he would still feel a certain, a certain kinship with the game. And I think in particular with Jesse's, you know, travel and whatnot and going from person to person, place to place or what it is, I just think Shobu is the kind of game that would appeal to him and that I don't see him getting rid of it.
Shobu is a game that goes with you. It travels with you. It is a centerpiece anywhere you put it. And with us considering a new move at some point, I'm assuming that Jesse's trying to think, I wonder what I can have at the guest table that can always just be there all the time. And I think Shobu is that perfect game. The word that I would associate, Alex, that would resonate with Jesse is like the spiritual side of like the board game and the enjoyment. That's what I get from Shobu. It's like a little piece of nature sitting on the table and just going through a very meditative state through what ends up being a very cutthroat game, but it definitely doesn't feel like that or doesn't look like that. So I'm going to say that Jesse's 100% keeping this, and he's trying to work on two sides of the board simultaneously to throw us off his track, but it won't work.
Cute little tie-in there.
Ah, well, thank you very much.
So here's the thing about Shobu.
I forgot
about Shobu for the entirety of the last year, for the most part. I mean, it's lived on my shelf behind the scenes, behind a few other games, to be honest, and just hasn't seen a lot of table play.
And if you only had it, you would have been able to meditate during this entire time and remember why you loved it so much.
All that being said, you're both absolutely right. I mean, Shobu holds up. It held up when I first played it. It continues to hold up now. It is this little abstract meditative puzzle that feels like it, you know, has always been around. The rules are simple enough. You can teach anyone. The game is complex enough. Most people will be rewarded and want to dive in one, two, three times in a single sitting. And Jan's 100% right. I think this game, if you approach it the way I would like to, I think this game could be a showpiece, just like you leave a chess or checkers board out on the middle of the table for a gameplay when friends come over just for a quick 10 or 15 minute cycle. This game deserves to be there. Now, that being said, one of the things I'm hoping to do sometime over the course of the next year is to start doing more crafty projects like woodworking and designing boards and building boxes.
Making your own Shobu?
Shobu seems like the perfect game to start with. How can you take a game like this and elevate it to another level? Make it something that is not just a game that comes in a $20 little box, but is a beautiful staple of what this industry is. And Shobu has held up. It's held up well enough that I would really like to do a little series or something like that, upgrading it and taking it to the next level, doing different tones and textures of wood, you know, sanding and oiling, and maybe even taking those base box components and upgrading them instead of starting entirely from scratch. All that being said, if anyone hasn't played Shobu so far, know that after a year and a half, there have been very few other abstract games that I feel like have come out that stand the test of time as well as this one does. And I'm very, very thrilled to have discovered and to still have this game in my collection.
Man, I agree with you so much. This is pretty much the exact visual definition of a modern classic. I don't think I've ever played a board game in recent time that felt literally ancient, but in a good way. Like it felt so traditional and essential that Shobu was literally a game that I was like, so this is a game that people have been playing for centuries, right? Yeah, exactly. Like this is as old as time itself, basically. And it's held up great all that time, but no, like it's kind of difficult to imagine that this was done now. Honestly, to this day, I still can't actually, like, I question it sometimes, like, maybe they found it in an old Chinese or Japanese manuscript somewhere in a scroll, and that's where they got the idea from.
Now, have either of you played TAC?
No.
I am familiar with TAC. I don't know that I've played it.
For me, TAC, everything you're saying, TAC was that game for me. TAC is a game that as well manages to feel like something has been around.
It is held up very well, too.
Yeah, it's a surprisingly good game. And Shobu, when I got Shobu, I was pulled in by all the things you're saying. And I will say, one of the things that Shobu definitely excels at compared to TAC is the combination of that rope, those boards, and those pebbles. It really feels like something that was... It feels like you're getting a something that was handed down
from
father to son in some village somewhere. Mm-hmm. It doesn't feel like you're getting a board game. Now, TAC does have wooden pieces. It's not, you know, plasticky or whatnot, but it's not the same production quality that Shobu brings to the table. But for me, while I appreciated and enjoyed the puzzle of Shobu, that aspect of managing the back and forth, you move a piece here, you move a piece there, you move a piece on this side, you move a piece across the rope. I appreciated the back and forth and the tactical nature of setting up a perfect finishing move. At the end of the day, for me, TAC is the one that stayed in my collection, while Shobu, despite how good it was, is one that eventually left.
Did it
leave? I said it used to be in my collection.
Oh. No, you did say it.
You did say it's still in your collection at the beginning of this video.
Well, actually, Jesse, going back to the previous episode, we were completely wrong about Alex saying what games he had or what he wanted or what games he didn't consider. He had 100% said Terraforming Mars and the two others when we really went hard in saying he didn't. So I'm going to trust Alex on this one.
I totally forgot about that conversation, but I'm glad to see that you did not.
You totally did. You proved us wrong, Alex.
So here's my thing. When I'm thinking about an abstract that I want to have in the middle of the dining room table, I'm either thinking about chess or checkers. They can be upgraded, they can be beautiful, and everyone knows them to some degree. Checkers, the most accessible little abstract game possible, and chess, a complex puzzle that everyone wants to sort of pick up and play with the pieces, even if they're not actively playing the game. When I think about Shobu, I think about a merging of that. Right? A puzzle, something that's a little weird, something that connects with nature that could be upgraded. How does TAC present in that sense? Because for me, I'm looking for something that anyone can walk into.
So TAC is going to hold up, but again, I don't think in the same comparison to Shobu. TAC feels more like a chess set. It has the simple pieces, almost like maybe checkers, perhaps. It has a simplified degree of pieces. There's only two types of pieces per player, and they're going to be different on each side. So the presentation is very, very minimalistic and all wood or whatnot with a board that is... I wish the board would, now that I think about it. The board is more of a cardboard standard board.
I'm looking at a wooden board right now. It looks amazing.
Ooh, I need the wooden board. I want the wooden board now. Yeah, TAC for me is my favorite abstract of all time, bar none. And again, Shobu is great, and Shobu is visually more stimulating and will have more of that aspect that you're looking for. But both are solid in different ways.
I sort of want to do like a little rock garden with Shobu there and the pieces spread out. Like that's what I have in my mind for it.
And you could. And you could. And that's the thing. I think Shobu will excel in that category.
Dude, look, I'm looking right now on Etsy. This person is Wooden Gifts by Joseph. 208 positive reviews for a TAC box set made from black walnut? Made from black palm, purple heart, buckeye burl, and acrylic. And it looks absolutely gorgeous.
How much
gorgeous.
Is that? How much is this before I say bought?
$375 modest dollars.
Is your game, is an upgraded version of your game, handcrafted, lovingly sewn, made from purple heart and black walnut, is that worth $300 and something?
I'm tempted.
Dude, all I'm going to say, this looks like it belongs in a museum, okay? This
it
looks like it belongs
in a museum.
So all I can say is I now know the perfect Christmas gift for Board Game Co. and his family. All that being said, Jan, what did you bring in?
Wow, I'm now distracted by these beautiful tack boards, and for some reason,
Jan,
I just need to have it.
48 hours. 48 freaking
God,
hours, my friend.
It's so hard. Okay.
I told you I wanted to do arts and crafts. I will get tack. I will upgrade it for you. No need to spend the money.
Are you
going to
do it out of burlai and purple heart wood?
Of course I'll do it out of burlai and purple heart wood.
Sure.
I mean, I've got standards.
Of course, the bare minimum standard is purple heartwood. Okay. By the way, listeners, if you know how to teach me impulse control, please, I need help. And with that said, I'm bringing in today, and I'm going to try and not do like the typical catchphrase I always do, And I'm not going to say it because then I would say it.
Wait, what's the typical catchphrase?
I can't say it because then I'm repeating myself all the time. I always do like...
Go ahead and let me know, just so I know.
And then I'm bringing in this, a little game. I'm not going to do it this time.
A little game's the typical catchphrase?
Yeah, I always say... I don't know why I just go for that.
That would be inappropriate in this case because you're not probably bringing in a little game.
Correct. And last time I said, I'm bringing in a little game by the name of Edge Dawnfall. I was like, no, that is the complete opposite either way.
Doesn't fit.
We are deviating from the conversation. Today, I am bringing in Rococo, the Deluxe Edition.
Oh.
Have either of you heard of this one?
Rococo.
I have.
It was published back in, let's see here, 2013? Is that accurate?
Yep. I think so. Right, Alex?
Rococo Deluxe is in the original. The original was published, back in 2013.
So, you know, this getting a Deluxe Edition today... That's really interesting. Like, Roko, the original, Jesse, has been out of print for the longest time. So this deluxe edition is not just a deluxification of a game that's, you know, available. It was more of a way of getting the game into people's hands, period.
And the original has some pretty good ratings overall. Rank overall, 226. Strategy, 146. A weight of 310. I mean, seems like it's held up. Instead of just a reprint or reimplementation, it seems like they're bringing back a game that has a lot of love behind it. The question is, does Jan like what most people like, or is Jan a stubborn, non-board game loving jerk?
Wow. Okay. We'll go and dive into that deeper, but first let's dive into this game. Rococo.
For the low price of $125 an hour, we'll dive into that deeper.
Maybe we should make a psychology-focused section on the podcast at some point. Either way, Rococo is a deck-building, hand-management, and area-majority game designed by Matthias Kramer, Stefan Malz, and Louise Malz, and published by Eagle Griffin Games. In Rococo, Louis XV reigns in France, and it's the height of fashion to attend his lavish balls where important luminaries dress up in extravagant gowns and fancy frock coats. In just a few weeks, Louis XV is hosting the final grand ball of the season, and
I don't think you're allowed to make that accent.
Is clamoring for you, the owner of a distinguished tailoring business, to provide them with something to wear. In the game, players play employee cards to perform a task, be that acquiring new materials, hiring new employees, or crafting a beautiful ensemble. However, employees are not always able to perform all tasks, so you must plan carefully how you direct them, especially as each employee grants a unique bonus, including some that generate you prestige, which are victory points in this game. The game is going to end after 7 rounds with a huge fireworks display and final scoring. You will gain prestige points for the sumptuous gowns and frock coats you have rented out to guests at the ball, certain employee bonuses, and the festive decorations you have funded. Whoever has collected the most prestige at the end of the game wins.
Yeah, so this one is... I'm torn because I don't imagine you keeping this game. I don't see what it is about this game that would pull you in.
This game is pretty incredible. So,
oh, it sounds amazing. Absolutely.
Yeah, it sounds wonderful. But I agree. I'm not quite convinced he'll hold on to it.
This feels like obsession to me. This feels like a game that you picked up because you saw the buzz, you heard the buzz, but you picked it up despite the fact that the theme held no real interest to you. But hey, there's a wave and you got swept up along
but
with it. And I don't even fault you.
Does Jin care about theme?
Yeah, I get swept up with these things too. Obsession, Rococo, they weren't on my radar either, and I plan on getting them. But once I get them, I think I like them. So I just don't see you keeping this, Jan. I mean, it's nice. It's
you
pretty.
Think... Your theory is, like most things, the hype was so high that Jan was eventually let down, despite the fact that the game is probably remarkable.
Absolutely incredible. An 8.4 on Board Game Geek, I mean, that's insane.
So, I've been supporting you in all of this, but I'm going to choose the opposite path. I think Jan absolutely found some remarkable elements of this game. He might not connect with the theme as much, but I think he's holding on to this one. I think this one was enjoyable enough for him. Now, there is one important question, though, which may give some insight depending on what he
question.
Chooses. Jan, how many people did you play this with?
I played it with 2.
Okay. It's best at 3.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
Okay, so everyone's keeping. Okay. So, I'm going to start this off right off the bat by saying that I absolutely hated the deluxification of this game. With that said,
why?
Rococo is now permanently in my collection. I absolutely adored this game. It is absolutely incredible. Okay? Absolutely incredible. I was not a fan of what they I was not a fan of everything that they did, but it's an amazing product. And I'm going to say this because Alex, there's a lot of validity to what you said. I don't necessarily agree with it 100%, but there is validity. I feel a certain responsibility as being part of Quackalope to try the hotness, to see what the talk is about so that I can be part of the conversation later on.
You're not really part of Quackalope. Yeah, you're not really part of Quackalope for another month.
Excuse you?
Also, you're like engaging with my statements as if I say them for the purposes of validity. That is a very remarkable assumption that is not the basis of how I interact with you at all.
No, but there is truth in it. That's what I mean. Like, for example, I will be bringing in Praga Kaput Rekni. I will be bringing in Hallertau. I will be bringing in Bonfire. I'm going to be tackling all of the big Euros. I'm not saying that I'll be able to talk about all the big Euros like people would hope I would talk about them, but I'm definitely bringing them to Shelf or Sell very soon. But with all that said, Rococo was an absolute delight, and not just that, for a game that was published in 2013 or whatever it was, it feels so surprisingly modern and contemporary in the way that it approaches deck building, because this is, at the end of the day, is a deck builder with hand management and almost like a worker placement component basically sewn in into every stitch. It's awesome.
I'm gonna be honest.
Did you use sewn into every stitch intentionally?
Maybe. Why?
Just because that's a very remarkably specific choice of words.
I also believe in trimming puns out of our conversation. All that being said, I did not realize that this was a deck builder. So I am highly intrigued now because I do really enjoy deck builders. Why do you hate the deluxification? What's going on?
No, I agree with him. The original art, while the deck, but the new one looks better at a glance. You're like, wow, I can't wait to see what they did with this. When you actually dig down into the art, I think there is an argument to be made for either one. But personally speaking, I prefer the original.
Okay, really? Well, this is an interesting discrepancy, Alex, because it is not the art that I am against.
Like I said, Jan is completely right when he says he prefers the art of the original.
I don't. Okay. I'm looking at both of them. I think the deluxified model looks remarkable. I mean, beautiful.
It's beautiful.
It's got an amazing aesthetic, bright, vibrant colors, that classic pastelish Ian O'Toole, approach to design. It has 3D spools and upgraded cards. That's where they lose me. Why don't you like the deluxification?
It's exactly that. So
the bits and bobs. Leave the bits and bobs alone. Leave them alone.
I am not loving the commoditization of our hobby lately. I don't like the trend that we're going, that everything just needs to be such an exaggeration. And actually, what I'm bringing into on the radar,
we're going to have this conversation in the Facebook group. If you go over to the Quackalope podcast,
that is an excellent question.
We are going to be talking about this. But like, first off, we're talking about a hobby industry that loves deluxified items and components to the point where we're just talking about a game that you're considering that is worth $350 because someone took the time to make a handmade version of it, and you're going to sit here and snub and grub because they put wooden spools in this game, which is
actually not wood, just
an upgrade from the original.
There are certain pieces of this that felt appropriate. Okay, there are definitely certain pieces that felt appropriate.
Based off of your sensibilities. Why don't we make this a print and play so everyone can have it for $5?
Okay, Jesse, let's not get ahead of ourselves. The new artwork, I think, is amazing. And again, it shows off Ian O'Toole's best characteristics and best techniques in incredible form. Every single inch of this game is impeccable. Like one little detail that I'm not sure if a lot of people will pick up on in the first play is that the area where all the resources are stored is actually a little drawer. Like, if you look closely at it, it is a little drawer with all the pieces of fabric, you know, stored in there.
Looks lovely.
Absolutely gorgeous. It's beautiful. I love everything about that. The areas where I wasn't 100% keen on were more of those kind of those tokens, those 3D pieces. They felt a little bit unnecessary. But specifically, it's mostly one component that I went like, okay, this is just too much. It was a little statuette that you get in the deluxe edition. I still don't understand what you use that for. I don't know if it's a first player token. I don't know if it's just a decorative piece. I don't know if it's a marker of some reason.
Did you not open the base?
He didn't even open the rule book.
Of course I did.
I'm saying the twist off base on the statuette, you didn't untwist it?
There's no twist off base, Alex. Stop it. The reason why I'm confused about it is because there's two pieces here that I still don't understand what they're for. There is a thimble, and there's also the statuette piece, and I believe that both of them represent first player. So it's like one of these things where it's kind of pushing into being gratuitous, right? I'm okay with having 3D components. I personally didn't need the 3D components. I was fine if they decided to do the wooden pieces and then maybe go with the coins. With that said, in other games, this would have been a huge deterrent. Was not enough to dissuade me from what this game does.
Jan, all right, I just have to say this. If you're going after the deluxification of components in an Eagle Griffin game, you're gonna need to sleep with one eye open, just like geese do, because they have the ability to literally sleep with one eye open. They can shut down half their brain to rest and even adjust how deeply they sleep based off of how wide their eye is open or closed. That's been a goose fact.
Oh, a goose factor moment. Okay.
Take a gander at that knowledge I'm dropping on your lap.
So before we move on to the next game, let me at least talk a little bit about mechanically what was special about this.
Besides those gratuitous components, do you still want this game when you could sell it for such a premium because it's so well made?
No, yeah, it is a fantastic product. No, it's... There's something really unique about the way that it approached the deck building and the hand management. So as I described in the overview, every single card that you're playing has a big consequence, because not just that you have this hand of cards, you actually go through your entire deck and select only three cards for your three actions during the entire game. So you have a lot of planning. The trick is that as you start spending these cards, they go into your discard, and then you have whatever's left of your main deck to continue choosing from. And that level of control was really gratifying, and felt that all of the decisions here and the result of this game were 100% squarely on my shoulders. And that was a good feeling, especially for a deck builder where... Honestly, there's a lot of random chance in deck builders. Like, sure, you can start building your deck towards a certain pattern, but here it does away with any randomization and puts everything on you. And that change was very apparent during the entire thing. The way that the resource collection works on this, and the way that you can start building up your actions through these cards and these employees that are coming out slowly but surely throughout the game, really does feel like you're building towards something better. The market deck is essentially composed of different tiers. So at the beginning of the game, you're getting employees that are, a little bit better than what you have in your base deck. And the mid game, you're getting something much better. And then by the end of the game, now you're, aiming for cards that can pretty much change the entire way that you score at the very end of that game. And not just that, every time that you get one of these cards, you're able to actually add to your turn. So it's almost like when we play Everdell, where we're always trying to push and push to see how far we can go. There's a little bit of that in this game. And I also love the assignment of roles. The different employees have a lot of different things that they focus on, but you kind of have to play where you can, because certain people are not going to be able to do everything. And you might have the intention of, hey, well, let me get the employee that I can do every action with. But their bonuses aren't really as strong or powerful as the lesser employees that can get you a bunch of materials for not necessarily for free, but you can get three materials in a single turn. And that's huge. I also was really, really impressed by the way that the area control in this game works. It's very simple, very straightforward, but it feels so tight and confined, but in a way that makes you try and think and adapt to the situation. Basically, what you're doing is that every time that you create a gown or some type of ensemble, you are putting it either, you're cashing it in and selling it to the highest bidder, or you are displaying it on a particular guest. And that guest now occupies a hall. And there's different types of halls with different types of scoring. So you can either try and control the bigger scoring areas, or you can go and take control of the smaller ones, like 3 points here, 4 points there, 5 points here. And then suddenly you're higher up than everybody else. Man, just the way that everything is interwoven in this is absolutely incredible.
I really want to play it.
The hype was right. The hype was completely right on this one. I loved it.
I didn't put money behind this game originally, not because I hadn't heard good things about the predecessor, but largely because I had quite a few other re-implementations and brand new Eagle Griffin games that I really wanted to get to the table. And I thought, out of the catalog, without knowing any of the details, one about being a seamstress or a seamster or whatever it is, the terminology, I didn't necessarily think that this one was going to be quite my jam, but it following on the back of Prediporter, I got to be honest, I may have a future career in the clothing industry.
For sure. And the last thing I'll say about the deluxification, I really appreciate the amount of variability that's in here. There's so, like, all the expansions are in. If you love this game, you'll never get tired of it. And with that said, Alex, I think it's your turn, buddy.
Well, I'm glad that we took a conversation around Shobu and now around Rococo, because I will continue the trend of elegant and refined games with Unicorn Fever. Unicorn Fever, which is essentially, and I kid you not, a game about racing chubby, deformed unicorns across a board. These unicorns genuinely look sick. I do not know if you're supposed to be racing them or if they're heading to the vet or something. I don't know.
That's just how unicorns look.
Is that really what unicorns look like?
Yeah, you've never seen
that
one?
That would explain why we've never seen them. They've gone extinct. No one wanted to mate with them. It makes a lot of sense now.
They all had the diabetes.
Yeah,
they never wanted to be born in the first place.
So Unicorn Fever is essentially a betting game where you control a unicorn. You do, to a certain extent, control a unicorn, but it's much more about placing bets and using abilities around the actual race of the game, because your own unicorn racing will give you a measly few dollars versus betting on the right unicorn will get you points, money, rolling it all in as you slowly take three actions across the course of four different distinct rounds. You'll take three actions each round before the race begins, before you start rolling dice and drawing cards to see which unicorn crosses the finish line first. With those three actions, you'll have to choose between increasing your tableau with abilities from various races, placing specific bets, earning more money, or just playing spell cards to negatively or positively affect the chances of various unicorns as they race towards the finish line. Rinse and repeat for four rounds and then see who's the winner of something, of unicorns. I'm not sure what these things are, but effectively do that until a winner is declared, and that, in a nutshell, is Unicorn Fever.
Wow, Alex, you do have no idea what a controversial game you have brought into this podcast.
I am so excited to hear what your opinion of this game
is. I'm excited too. I'm just worried about yours, Jesse.
Here's my thing. I'm so excited, I'm not going to put in a vote before Alex speaks.
What
do you mean?
Oh, come on. All right. I will put in a vote without any commentary. I think Alex, I think he's keeping this game.
Really? Because if he keeps it, I'm keeping mine. Okay, Alex, here's a little bit of context on our side.
No.
What do you mean? The context is not going to change my opinion mid-podcast.
Yeah. We tried to play this game. And Jesse was so vehemently against it that he stood up from the table on the first round.
Alex?
Yes, sir?
I despise this game.
What do you despise so much about the game, Jesse?
Oh, it's so dumb and abstract. It's pulling a lever that allows your horses to race, just like the casino games. There's very little control
over... Which is the point!
There's very little control over your unicorns doing anything. I mean, mine got completely screwed out of any actions. I bet on one horse, the yellow one, of course, naturally.
Which was your mistake?
Got completely screwed out during... I mean, it's so brainless. It's like going to a gambling machine, putting in $30 and pretending like you might potentially get something back, or the algorithm has worked entirely against your favor.
Jesse, in round two of this game,
despise.
I bet my entire fortune, my legit entire fortune against a unicorn that had 4-1 odds. I bet every penny I owned because two of the other players at the table were backing that unicorn, and I saw an opportunity to go home with three people behind the same unicorn, walking away with $200 and 3 points in order to live out the rest of my life in dreams and harmony. And then my daughter backed another unicorn, that unicorn won, and I got nothing. Absolutely nothing. I lost every single cent of this game.
I think you're keeping it because it's a raucous good time and you had a fantastic evening with your friends.
Of course, I'm keeping it. That was the best moment of the entire night. Losing my entire fortune is something that shouldn't have happened.
Yes, I knew it.
Again, let me reiterate. I also voted.
Oh my God!
Alex.
No! Let him talk. I want to hear about this.
No, I voted he was keeping this game as well. That being said, I don't like this game.
You're wrong, Alex.
This game is amazingly fun. It's the moment.
I knew it!
So first of all, no, let me start with the first baseline here. If a game that has pure chance that delivers those moments does not do it for me, this game is not pure chance. There is control. There are decisions. Each of the actions you take is progressively better at the beginning rather than as you go down those action piles, which means you want to take the most efficient card play action, but no, you have to take the most efficient betting action. Every action is going to be better in a different sense, and you have to choose the order that you're going to execute. And there's tenseness to it, because locking in a bet early is great, because you can actually go for the win, but if you do it too early, other people will back other horses. There are certainly decisions, reading the table, choosing your actions that all matter. And at the end of it all, blind luck can lead to stupid moments where things happen that are hilariously funny. The game plays in roughly 45 minutes, and in those 45 minutes, you manage to make choices and also just have an absolute blast. My favorite moment of that hour I played, whatever it was, my favorite moment by far was losing every cent I owned when I should have walked away the richest man at the table.
I knew this game would be fun. Jesse didn't want to give it a shot. I was so excited for it.
I gave it a shot. I sat down.
No, you didn't. You stood up in the first round.
I played it, and then I hard noped out.
Exactly. That's not giving a game a chance. Giving a game a chance is playing the game until it's done.
Now, I will say I am not a fan of the theme. The theme itself is, it's everything about the theme screams kids game.
I liked the theme.
Oh, well, we're just completely at odds here. I'm okay with that. Let's double down on that. The theme on this game, everything about this theme screams like this is a game designed for six-year-olds. And don't get me wrong, my daughter is thrilled to have a unicorn game in the collection.
Six-year-olds and older bronies. I mean, you got to extend that franchise to anyone that loves Adventure Time or those weird cartoony adaptations of mythical landscapes and worlds. I'm talking about Hilga. I'm talking even about Rick and Morty to some degree. I mean, this fits into that genre. The art, the aesthetic, the cards, everything feeds into this beautiful little chaotic world.
It's definitely adult humor.
If only the gameplay was good.
The gameplay is good, Jesse. It's fun. It's fun. It's not. This is not a game that I am recommending to anyone who's like, yes, Food Chain Maggot and Viticulture and a little bit of Scythe when you're done with that. Unicorn Fever. No,
this is supposed to be my chaos game. That's what I wanted it to be.
This is just fun. This is end of the night. You got an hour. You want to play something that's going to give you strategy, give you choices, but ultimately result in people slamming down their whatever and storming away from the table, just saying no. Oh, wait, technically, I did that to you guys.
So this is your party. Exactly. This is your party game.
To an extent, yes.
I also universally don't like party games.
That's fair. Jesse doesn't like
fun.
You're
not a people person. It's okay.
Can we get that on a t-shirt, Jen? Jesse doesn't like fun?
No, it's definitely going. Now it is.
So that is basically Unicorn Fever. Deluxe, very refined, very stylish, very whatever.
Refined?
Yeah, the whole Rococo, and I'm just feeding off the vibe of the evening. So Unicorn Fever, check it out. Sickly unicorns crossing the finishing line.
I'm so excited that you like this. Alex, okay, this is how I imagined that this game would play out. Was there a moment where everybody was standing around the table, almost like holding money in their hands, just screaming like, go, come on, you can do it, please, just make it to the end.
I don't think any of us lost control quite that much, but it was, there were multiple moments throughout the races where you're hoping your unicorn crosses the line and you're playing those cards. Now, I do wish the cards had a bit more variability. The cards mostly come down to move an extra space or don't cross the finish line. The cards are fairly basic across the board. I do like the races, the tableau building of getting your race abilities from the various elves or witches or fairies, whatever it is. Those are fun. Mm-hmm. The actual cards you play.
There is no control.
Jesse,
there is
you're
no,
your
there
lack
is no
of scene
read.
Control is
there
not
is
the
no
same thing.
There is no read on the strategy. There is no control. It is literally randomly pulling a lever and watching.
Jesse, you played the game wrong. You're not supposed to put all your money on the first race on a single horse when you haven't when you don't even know how the race goes. It's
Wait,
just
you
crazy.
Put all your money down on a single horse in the first round?
Yes.
No. I just put most of my money down.
Yeah, it's ridiculous.
Did you take
and then
a
he's
loan?
Complaining.
There are loans. You can go into debt.
I also was expecting this to be much more like the llama game than or the camel game, camel up. Than yep. a pull the lever and watch things run to the finish line. I was expecting
like that's what makes it fun.
No,
it
I was
kind
like,
of
it
just
makes
sounds
it
like
expected.
No one taught you the rules until the lever
well,
was pulled.
Jam taught me the rules.
Did
no,
you
no, no,
understand
no, no. I,
that the race was going to go straight to the finish as soon as it started?
I had no idea the race was going to go straight
and
to the finish.
And there we have it.
He wasn't paying attention to me. I explained everything.
This is four individual races across four rounds. Yeah.
I had no idea the race was going to that finish line when you pulled the lever. I hard noped out because there's just no.
So this
is
the equivalent of you playing Agricola for the first time and being like, and I put down my worker here and everyone's like, okay, great. And that's the game over. Jesse, you lost. And you're like,
yes,
that's,
exactly.
Wait, what
that's
just
what
happened
I tried
here?
To explain to him. He didn't give it a shot. He didn't let the game actually play at all. It was so unfortunate. Oh, man. Alex, thank you so much for validating my spur of the moment purchase. I am very excited that I can play this now with the appropriate amount of people and have fun with it how I knew I would. Thank you. Jesse, I see. I told you. I told you it was a fun game. You didn't want to listen.
Can we relax just a bit? Oh, my God.
Settle down, it's time for our Medley Minute, a moment of respite before the rest of our show.
You know what, Jesse? You're right. Let's relax, let's take some time to smell the roses.
These roses have thorns!
No, these roses are based in Keystone, North America. My Medley Minute for today is actually the announcement of a completely new publisher to a certain degree. Isaac Vega and Lindsay Rhode launch Rose Gauntlet Entertainment. Their first release is called Keystone, North America.
I see what you did there.
Published by Rose Gauntlet, co-founded by Isaac Vega. And to give you an idea who Isaac Vega is, he's one of the designers of Dead of Winter Crossroads. He is one of the designers of Forgotten Waters and is the sole designer of Ashes Reborn, Rise of the Phoenix Born. And the game is going to also be designed by a newcomer by the name of Geoffrey Joyce. We're going to hear a little bit more about it in quarter two later in the year. But I find this to be a really interesting pair up. There's a little bit of a vision statement here. The vision behind Rose Gauntlet Entertainment was created from two great needs they both felt were missing in their careers. The first need was to have complete freedom over their art and to tell the stories that would reflect parts of who they were. The second was to build a home for their community that could foster a welcoming, engaging, and creative environment where people would be able to connect with others through a love of gaming. So I'm really excited to see what exactly they're planning and what is going to make what's going to make their particular set of titles very different.
Looking at their news post right now, they're talking about a tabletop RPG called Life After Dungeon, with a beautiful title and immaculate art, talking about what happens to your heroes after they venture forward. And then they have Gone to Gaia, which is not a game that I know anything about so far. But to be fair, if that's the cover art for it, or if that's an aesthetic vision of it, I'm already intrigued.
Well, and this is really interesting. So the name is not Rose Gauntlet Games. It's Rose Gauntlet Entertainment, because that Gone to Gaia game is actually a video game roguelike that's going to come later on.
That's cool.
So, is that the first time that a publisher has come out?
I don't know that it's the first time, but I do love watching as our industry grows, more and more people that venture in, and you know, like Ivy Studios would be a good example. An animation department that said, let's do a board game wing. I love watching skill sets and development personalities bring in and say, we can make a video game and pair it with a board game, and yep. both of those IPs will enhance each other. It means our space is transforming.
Man, and the artwork from Keystone, beautiful. That should go on an actual science book.
So, with that medley minute out of the way, another publisher that we need to reach out to and keep an eye on over the next year or so, my medley minute is going to be focused on a more historic title, one that I think Alex will have a degree of respect for. I'm talking about Ticket to Ride Europe, specifically the 15th Anniversary Edition.
Oh, another deluxified game?
Absolutely.
I mean, they've done this before with the original. They had the 10th anniversary of the original.
They have.
So they're just,
Alex,
they're continuing the trend.
I'm glad you brought that up, because this is where I think I'm going to gain your respect. I thought I'd put a note out for any of our fans who love Ticket to Ride, who want to have a upgraded or deluxified version of one of their favorite games, a core family game, a game that I think deserves all the respect in the world for the way that it's entered a lot of people into our hobby. This version of the game is, like the original 10th anniversary, going to introduce brand new player colors, going to bring in all of the different route cards that have been released over every expansion up to this date, and will just excel with new artwork, new design, that Europe edition of the game, just like the 10th anniversary did for the USA version. Here's the core thing, Alex. That USA version right now, do you have any guess what the price range is for it for those that want that deluxified experience?
$172.
No, sir. Originally published at a price range of $90 to $100, just like this Europe edition will be in quarter one of this year, the deluxified version, the 10th anniversary edition, is sitting right at $250 all the way up to $300 and $400 on BGG.
Wow. That is impressive. And Jesse, you're right. I am impressed with you.
So, for those of you that love Ticket to Ride, that want a deluxified experience of this historic family game, I very much think you should keep your eyes and ears open for when this releases. Again, quarter one of this year, you can sign up for a newsletter that lets you know, but this is a game that will sell out. Millions of copies have already been sold of the core game, and so people are going to be buying this deluxified version hands down. I mean, hand over foot. And so if you want the upgraded version, this will be your best chance to get that into your household. And if you just want to buy it and resell it in a few years for four or five times the price, also a good opportunity.
I have to say, those little train meeple, little train miniatures are absolutely adorable.
They're great. Well, here's the thing. Anyone that knows that original version, it's not too much of a step away from what they did. I do have to say, the deluxified version of Ticket to Ride is well worth the price when it first came out. It's not worth $400, but there's enough demand that, of course, it's going to sell for that. But at $100 a pop, if you like Ticket to Ride, yeah, get this. Just do it. It's just a good investment across the board. They really do know how to make their game slightly more special.
And let's be honest, if it was on Kickstarter, that would be a deal at double the price.
Oh, easily.
Yeah, and speaking of which, or not speaking of which in the slightest, today's medley minute for myself is going to be an announcement for the newest expansion for Caverna. The original Caverna, not the two-player game. Okay. But Caverna Frantic Fiends is going to be coming out, and this is going to be, there's not much about it, but Frantic Fiends are ravaging the lands and are threatening your caves and families. Can you defeat the ravaging orcs and bring back peace and prosperity to your people? Frantic Fiends is the second big expansion to A. Rosenberg's award-winning Caverna the Cave Farmers, and offers a marvelously mean twist. Strategy experts will try to find the dominant strategy for this threat, while beginners will struggle to survive. Do you have what it takes? I don't know why that was a selling point, that last sentence there. Strategy experts will try to find a dominant strategy, while beginners will struggle to survive. Recruit your new friends to Caverna
and
butcher
them. I heard you say, I get to not only build a farm, but also defend it from raiding bands of orcs. And am I sold on that premise? Every day of the week.
So, okay, Alex, do you own Caverna?
I own Caverna. I don't think I own the expansion. I have a broken token. That's what I have. I have Caverna, a broken token, and I have not played it, and I really need to.
Oh, you never played Caverna?
Nope. I played Agricola, and I like the promise of Agricola while not liking aspects of it, and those aspects sound like they would be improved by Caverna, and so I got it. and it proceeded to sit on my shelf.
I've never played any of them, but I am so intrigued by the idea of animal farming and keeping a healthy, docile sheep farm that I cannot wait for when I get to experience these games.
We seriously need to play Lowlands.
Jan, like, I have played Lowlands.
Oh.
I thought it was a interesting approach to a weird cooperative Euro game that provided a threat that everyone had to balance. I wasn't sold by the entire experience of the game, but I also did play it in a open gaming hall with people who were learning the rules as we sat down. So I would be open to trying it again, even though I wasn't sold by that first initial dip into it.
Okay. Well, this is the type of game, Alex, that I'm surprised there's an expansion coming out. I think it just kind of goes to show that that games that are good in this hobby don't ever really go away.
Yeah, I mean, keep in mind, there's games that are good, and then there's games that have really been around for like a long time and still manage to get bought, acquired continuously again and again and again. Caverna is an evergreen at this point, and evergreens, they keep rearing their heads. I mean, think about Agricola. It's out for years and years, an expansion. When that was all done, what do? Agricola Revised Edition, where they bundled everything together. There's always room for another part of the conversation, depending on how things go over time.
Yeah, I'm excited about this. I want to try the core. I want to try the base game. Maybe Jan and I will be able to do that sometime soon. I know we have a lot of historic games that whenever we're able to get back together. We're legitimately, whenever Jan and I are able to reconnect, planning to play through and cover as many historic games as possible. So get ready for a catch-up marathon, kind of like one of those 80s sitcoms where we just play everything available. I am sure this will be on the list.
What's going to be our catchphrase, Jesse? Like, when we first open, like, it can't be Hello, Hello. We need to come up with something original if it's going to be a sitcom.
Good point. We'll think on it.
Jan and Jesse, they don't like fun.
Alex, you better be careful, because human punishment may be a virus that infects you sometime soon. Speaking of which, I am bringing in for my... Is that a good transition? Does that work?
No,
I mean, because we can continue with it at this point.
No, continue.
For my on the radar, I am bringing in Human Punishment The Beginning, a social deduction game like something you've probably never seen before. This takes
a
weird degree of asymmetric character powers, variable win conditions, and almost a worker placement or Euro-style board experience and pulls it into the social deduction world. You're doing your very best to work as a set of one of five different factions. And let's see if I can remember them all. You have the humans, you have the machines, which have pretty straight win conditions. They're all trying to influence the network together, trying to get their code in above the others. You have the Legion, which is going to be an alien species slowly converting the hive mind to, control and convert humans and robots alike into their squadron. You have the Fallen, which is going to exist in the junkyard, where if you put the right amount of code in either the network or the junkyard, the Fallen one will unveil this weird robot creature and they will win. And then you also have the Outlaws, which is really the ambient anti-player faction, which is the creatures, the Munchsters, and all the other things that live across the board state. There is an opportunity for you all to betray each other enough that the board wins and no one brings the victory home. This is, I would venture to say, one of the most aggressive takes on social deduction games that I've seen. Have you all been paying attention to this campaign at all? And do you have any questions? Because I believe I'm the only person with an actual prototype.
Sure. Yes, so, I have all the questions.
Yeah, I have all the questions too. This game was originally like Human Punishment. Originally was like a social deduction, pure
small
social deduction.
Yeah. Social deduction.
And now it's like a pick up and deliver game. Like, what happened here?
Pick up and deliver, I found it weird that they advertise themselves as pick up and deliver. There is a degree of get these certain network chips into different locations on the board, but the core gameplay is much more about action selection and choosing to upgrade your asymmetric characters and utilizing the cards that you have than it is about pick up and deliver. Pick up and deliver is really not the core feature of the game for me.
Well, isn't that what pretty much drives the entire game forward, getting from something from point A to point D?
It is the time sequence of the game. Yes, it is also the win condition of the game. But the heart of the game has a lot more to do with the interaction between player characters, the sussing out what people may or may not be doing. I mean, the pick up and deliver is not in a traditional sense. It's not a ticket to ride style, connect your chains of production or grab resources from this one location to another. I understand why it's there, but it's not the heart of the game, in my opinion.
So one of the things that in my mind would make this really exciting is that if the different paths are not linear, you're able to kind of interpret why people are going to certain areas, trying to understand like, oh, they're probably going here so that they can do this. And it's almost like social deduction stretched out, like taking everything that usually happens in mere seconds or minutes and just making it into an entire round, which I find really interesting.
So there are two core paths that you can take. The reason why I don't think pick up and deliver is the main feature of this game is because really it's not about route building or choosing a variety of different options. There's two core routes that you take to get to the network. One of which is going to pass you through the city, where you're trying to balance the chaos that exists across the board state, keeping either some of your opponents from winning early or, you know, the city descending into chaos and the outlaws, which is the ambient player, from stealing victory. The other option is going to pass you through a few different networks or zones that take you longer to get to that final place where you want to place down your chip, but allow you to do things like craft the human's robot support character, or heal yourself a little bit on the way, or pick up scanners that allow you to reveal the chip that you're placing down, giving you a little bit of insight into or basically showing the players around the table what you're willing to do to help them out, proving, in fact, that you are a human. So it does have a bit of that. It certainly has locations that you're going to. Each location has a multitude of actions, and as other players take actions, you're not sure if it's because they're against you, it's because their secret objective is something very specific and refined, or if they are potentially on your team and trying to balance the state of the world. You are definitely reading into their decisions throughout the course of this game.
Well, one thing that I definitely find really interesting about it is that it does. I've heard comparisons already to Nemesis and Battlestar. You know, I've seen those
Nemesis and Battlestar Galactica. It's pretty impressive.
Yeah, it screamed at the page that this is going to be like the killer of Battlestar Galactica and Nemesis. Like this is the evolution.
I saw a lot of reviews with that, and of course, it's a interesting point to bring up, right? Because Battlestar Galactica would be the most well-known heavy social deduction game out there on the market. Do I know if this kills Battlestar Galactica? I'm not sure. I need to see more players get this into their hands. I need to see more reviews and more feedback. Do I think that this is in the category of heavy social deduction games? And if you like that category, you should be paying attention. Yeah, I do.
Well, and one of the things that this does completely different to both of those is that you can play it in lower player counts, right? They very publicly.
I was
publicly.
Just about to say, yeah. Jen, you just keep on taking all my things just as I'm about to say them. So social deduction is one of my favorite genres, but I find historically it works best at 5+, and even at 4 and 5, it usually feels like a compromise. This one is saying it works with only 3 players, and if it's true, if it actually does, I mean, the only other social deduction game that I know that works with 3 players is both of your favorite games, one at Ultimate Werewolf works brilliantly at 3 players.
I knew it.
I am very intrigued.
So here's the interesting thing. The prototype that I was sent was heavily balanced for 4, 5, and 6 players. And so 3 players is not something that I can accurately speak towards yet. But I can say that the variability in different player abilities and factions that you have do leave enough openness in the conversation that I could see it functioning at a lower player count as you're working to drive your own personal objective home and you're not quite sure who else is sitting around the table. It's not as ambient as some of the games where you're trying to really suss out what other players are doing. There's a lot of cognitive and purposeful decisions that are being made, and you're trying to read into that as players take those actions.
That's really fascinating, and I guess going back to the idea of the comparison, what I like about the idea of these big box games is giving you the opportunity to see what people do and how that kind of leads into a strategy, right? Because for example, in Battlestar Galactica, what I know about it, going through a particular hall or doing a particular thing in the spaceship could pretty much give you clues as to what's happening versus in games like Secret Hitler or One Night Ultimate Werewolf, where it's more about kind of like the happenstances of what's going on around the player and how they're responding to things. Here, it is the actions, it is the decisions that they're making that start painting a picture of what's going on. For example, and I'm imagining, Jesse, that in this game, if you see a player going for really aggressive tactics in their skill building, then I'm assuming that that's a player that's probably planning on doing something that's not necessarily beneficial for the entire table at the end. I don't know. Like, I feel there's a lot more information.
The asymmetric nature of the game could allow you to justify a counter community action as something that just upgrades your character so you can benefit everyone down the road. There's a lot of information here and there's a lot flowing. That being said, you know, I don't want to give the impression that this is right for anyone that plays social deduction games. This is very much so a heavy social deduction game. It's going to take a lot of time on the table. You know, we're talking 2.5 to 3 hours on average. It's going to have a lot of different asymmetric player powers to learn, and understanding the abilities on the table will be better if you've played with the same group time and time again, because if you don't know the actions and you have to pause in the middle of the game to ask questions, you're kind of giving away information then as well.
Have you been able to play this one at all, Jesse?
Yeah, I have been able to test this one out, but I haven't been able to play it at the higher player counts, which is where I would like to.
So I think you have played Nemesis at a 4-player count, right?
Sure.
Because I'm assuming that that's what you played. How would you compare them? Do you think that the quotes that we've been seeing here are apt? Do you feel there's certain similarities or just completely off?
I don't know where this one compares to Nemesis necessarily. Nemesis is a weird game for me. I don't really like it. And we've been over that.
You prefer Lockdown.
We've been over that. I do prefer Lockdown. Lockdown gives me a lot more control of the games, you know, the game itself. Mm-hmm. Than of this social deduction game. In my sense of things, this is much more of a social deduction experience that is heightened and highlighted, as opposed to Nemesis, which exists as a tabletop game experience where the randomness might prevent you from winning, but not prevent the game from happening, right? This isn't a cinematic experience. This is a game. And so the comparisons to Battlestar Galacta are a lot more close to home. I just don't know if it competes or like closes out on a historically well-known game.
Yeah, well, color me intrigued. I mean, I don't know exactly where this lands, but I do love social deduction, and Nemesis, while I haven't given a shot, Battlestar Galactica did stay in my collection for quite some time before I eventually moved on from it. So yeah, I haven't done a full deep dive of the Kickstarter yet, but I'm certainly more intrigued than I was at the beginning of this conversation.
Oh, Alex, you've played Battlestar Galactica then?
Yeah, I owned it for a bit, but enough about Battlestar Galactica, or Human Punishment, as it were. For myself, this week, I am bringing in Carnegie. Carnegie, which is going to be by Quinet Games, designed by Xavier George, and is currently on Kickstarter. And this is going to be a heavy Euro, and a fairly heavy Euro. I don't know exactly how high it ranks, but it's basically a game that's going to take place over 20 rounds. And in those 20 rounds, what you're going to do is each of the players are going to take turns defining and picking the main action for the round, at which point all players will take that action together. And along the way, you're building up your departments, each of which will specialize in these 4 different actions. And so you want to sit there and try to figure out how to build out your own tableau, build out your own unique special advantages so that you can take the action that rewards you the most, while also being sure to balance your departments, because ultimately the players will be taking different actions and you want to be able to take advantage of everything that's happening when it happens, as it happens. And keeping an eye on the players, on the board, on what's going on is going to be key to figuring out what you need to do to win this game, because there's a bunch of objectives going on, from slowly building out across the board to, like I said, building out those departments, to giving charitable gifts, which ultimately will turn into victory points in terms of different ways you can build out your special advantages or different things you've done better than other players throughout the game. That's going to effectively go on for roughly 2 hours or so. It's a roughly 40 minutes per player, and I would say that's a roughly accurate number. But at the end of the day, it's an optimization strategy game about maximizing your competitive advantage while being mindful of everything else going on at the table.
So, Alex, just like Tinner's Trail, will this game allow me to be a steel entrepreneur, or specifically the word is a telegraph operator and a major player in the rise of the United States steel industry, making me one of the richest men in the world? Basically, I'm asking, in a very long-winded and disrupted sequence of sentences, Will this game, just like the Tinner's Trail, give me that thematic environment that I'm looking for when you're talking about the 1940s steel industry or 1840s steel industry in the United States?
You're forgetting philanthropy, Jesse, which is a cornerstone of this one, too.
They put that in there to make sure that people were okay with creating a game about a steel baron.
I assume not on both counts, honestly. So I've played the original Tinner's Trail and I have played this Carnegie. I've not played the new Tinner's Trail, so for disclaimer there. But the original Tinner's Trail did a half decent job at making you feel like you were building out mines. The thematic tie-ins were, I would say, I mean, don't get me wrong, this is no Root
Me in the last episode that Tinner's Trail would not give me the experience of I'm a tinner.
I'm dialing it back here as well. I'm saying that it does give you that feeling a bit, but it's certainly no Root or Nemesis. That was literally the sentence I'm saying. It's abstracted, but at least somewhat there. Versus Carnegie, to me, it barely feels like anything happening thematic. I mean, sure, you're building out your departments, and sure, you're giving charitable donations, but the charitable donations are otherwise known as how to earn victory points in the game, which I guess... thematically speaking, I think I view charitable donations as the same way in real life So
the charitable donations are a core part of this game.
The charitable donations are a core part of the game. Ultimately, it's one of the biggest areas of how you score points in the game. I mean, so I think I'm trying to remember the scores I had, but like let's say for one game I ended with like 140 points. Roughly 30 points were from the board, and then about 100, maybe a little less than that, maybe around 80 or so of my points were from charitable donations. Each of those.
It follows the organic sequence of life that I think a lot of people follow when it comes to education and then ambition and success followed by, you know, charitable giving or investment in the communities around you. I mean, it is how his life when you go historically, it is how his life operated. He became a steel baron that was very, very successful in the United States in the bludgeoning brand new United States of America, and ended up investing in thousands of public libraries. So good on him and good on the game, I suppose.
Alex, although that is fascinating, and I'll probably want to read up a little bit more on Mr. Carnegie later on, but I think you've already played this game.
Yes.
And I have a question that you'll get to answer depending on what your thoughts were. If you loved this game, if you liked this game, how did it play? What was like the best thing about it? And if you didn't like it, why wasn't it for you? Which of those do you fall under?
Excellent question. So I like this game, but that's where I am with the game right now. And I want to get another game or two in before I do a review. But I've played it both online on Board Game Arena, as well as I have a physical copy as well. And the game,
you have a physical?
Yeah. I got the physical copy from the publisher. I'm going to be putting out a review shortly for the game.
Oh.
And I will say that so far, I'm really liking the puzzle that Carnegie is giving me. And I think it's going to be one that I want in my collection. I'm pretty sure that's where I'm leaning towards so far. But I will say that even no matter where it ends up for me, I think it very much is a solid game with the right crowd. Because for me, Carnegie falls into that category of game that is slightly heavier than it is thematic. Games like Pipeline ring to mind. Pipeline is a game that I actually left my collection because I just found it way too thinky with not enough interaction and no real thematic tie into actually playing the game.
I agree with that.
Yeah, and so Carnegie for me has more of a thematic tie-in, more interaction, and I really appreciate the variability that the departments bring to the table. Meaning specifically, the biggest thing you're going to be managing this game is how you build out your departments are going to be your competitive advantages. And I will say that the base departments you get in the game, which would ultimately be presenting the same puzzle every single time, I would absolutely not get the game in and of itself. But on Kickstarter, they have doubled the amount of departments there are. And every game is still going to have a limited subset, giving you significantly more variability to the puzzle being presented every single time. And I think that's what's going to keep me coming back to the table, trying to figure out which departments to build in what order and how to take my actions and what sequence and put my guys on the board and then collecting income and doing all that, managing all that. It's specifically going to be the variability combined with the thinkiness that keeps me coming back. This is the kind of game where some people, and I think this is a problem I had with Pipeline as well, where some people just appreciate min-maxing and optimizing their way through the same puzzle until they figure out the perfect way to score a million victory points. And that's not my thing. I like being presented with a pathway that I have to figure out.
Except in Beat Saber.
except in Beat Saber. Beat Saber is a totally different experience. But yeah, I appreciate being presented with new puzzles that I have to see and find the common thread every time. And for me, without that variability, it would be a hard pass for me. A good game, but not for me. With that variability, I think this one has a spot in my collection.
Man, it looks... The reason why I'm asking is because I really, really kind of want it. It looks absolutely incredible. And if we're still doing this pretty, pretty please with sugar on top, Quinn Games, if you're listening, I'd love to try this one. Pretty, pretty please.
I mean, that joke only works in one episode, and this is not the one.
No, so I can't do it again? Darn it. But seriously, though, I do have a follow-up question to this, Alex. I think you already kind of answered this, but I'm having a little bit of trouble deciding if I should just wait for the retail edition of this one, or if I should just go with what they have right here on the Kickstarter.
So I can answer that pretty quickly. The Kickstarter is going to give you a few different options. It's going to give you, because it's going to be a higher price point, I guarantee you that. But it's going to give you different options. It's going to give you the additional departments, like I mentioned. It's doubling the amount of departments, but those will be available as paid add-ons after the fact. So that is something that's available. As far as the other extras, they're giving you some upgraded components or things. Nothing essential, like, you know, wooden tokens, laser edge discs or whatever it is. Stuff that I wouldn't consider essential at all. And then lastly is going to be the, and not lastly, lastly, but the last main big thing is going to be the insert, the game trays insert. I would say if you're trying to be as cost conservative or cost conscious as possible, I would focus on getting it at retail and with those additional departments. That'll likely be your cheapest option. But if you do value the component upgrades, if you do value the game trays, then Kickstarter might be the way to go.
Do you think it'll be a considerable price difference between both?
I mean, I would say so, just given the price point on Kickstarter right now is at $79 plus shipping. And a game like this at retail usually will start at the $50 range. So yeah, I mean, ultimately, I'm speaking for myself, I'm getting this on Kickstarter. I'm 99% sure tonight. I just need another game to lock it in. But I'm liking the puzzle, and the variability is really what's going to keep me coming back.
Can I play this one with you when you do?
Speaking for myself, I don't feel like I need to get this on Kickstarter because Jan and I are going to be partners for the rest of our lives and he will have a copy.
Oh my God. Jesse, I spoke about you and played it once if you haven't listened to it yet, by the way.
I haven't listened to it, but I would like to say this. If we're still single by 45, can we commit to marrying each other?
Okay.
So, Jay, what have you been
your reaction? Yes, your reaction to that was the funniest thing.
Alex, thank you so much for throwing me rope there, buddy.
Did you see his reaction, though?
Okay. We're jumping back into the show. Real talk. I'm bringing in Castles of Mad King Ludwig, the deluxe edition that is currently on Kickstarter for my On the Radar. And this game... This is a classic in a lot of respects, but I will still give it its due diligence of giving you an overview just in case for people that may have not been exposed to this one earlier on.
Like me.
So Castles of Mad King Ludwig is a set collection tile laying and drafting game designed by Ted Auspach and published by Bezier Games. The latest in a long trend of classics going through deluxification. In the Castles of Mad King Ludwig, players are tasked with building an amazing, extravagant castle for King Ludwig II of Bavaria, one room at a time. Each player acts as a building contractor who is adding rooms to the castle he's building, or she, while also selling his services or hers to other players in the game. Each player starts with a simple foyer. One player takes on the role of the master builder, and that player sets price for a set of rooms that can be purchased by the other players, with them getting to pick from the leftovers after the other players have paid them for their rooms. When a room is added to a castle, the player who built it gains the castle points based on the size and type of the room constructed, as well as bonus points depending on where you're placing this castle. And when a room is completed, you get even more points. After a purchasing round, a new player becomes a master builder and sets prices all over again. After multiple rounds, the game ends, then additional points are awarded for achieving bonus goals. Whoever ends up with the most castle points wins the game. And here's the thing about this particular conversation, and it is mostly an excuse to talk about another subject, but I will talk a little bit about what's in the Kickstarter and then jump into why I actually brought this in.
Didn't we already have the conversation today about overdone Kickstarters?
No. We're definitely going to get into it now.
Why this one is here, because...
What is going on with you today, Jen?
Are you a fan of this core game?
Yeah, okay, so that's exactly what I wanted to talk about. Yes, I remember owning Castles of Mad King Ludwig, one of the first games.
Past tense.
Yes, it's definitely a past tense game. It's not necessarily very, very intro, but it definitely is in the lighter side of our hobby, which I'm not saying that I don't have any lighter games. I just, I kept very few of them. I lean much more into heavy Euros for some reason. And this obviously isn't it. But with that said, the game was really fun. It was interesting, had a lot of player interaction, you know, the almost like the bidding and setting up prices and figuring out this little puzzle on your side was always really fun. However, Yo solía tener. Yeah, you're pretty close. Pretty close.
See.
The artwork on this one was atrocious, honestly. And I really like the new re-implemented aesthetic that they're bringing into the collector's edition. It is genuinely beautiful, and I think that is a really good step in the right direction. This new edition also includes some expansions. I never got into the Secrets expansion in the past. I'm assuming it was really good, but the decrees on this one, which are now basically asymmetric player powers, sounds really intriguing. In a tile laying game, I love anything that differentiates me from other players and gives me different access to abilities or different types of tiles or different ways that I can use my tiles, so that sounds super, super fun. And a little bit more controversial, at least for me, it does have another expansion, another module, which is called the Towers module with with minis.
Jan?
Lots of minis.
Jan, no seas un hipocrata.
Oh, don't be a hypocrite.
Uh-huh. See?
Why am I being a hypocrite, Jesse?
See? Oh, deluxification, and now you're doubling back and going back and forth.
No, Jan.
Was it, do you hate the decommodification of our industry, or do you not?
No. So, I like the new artwork, and I like that they're refreshing the game. What I'm not a big fan of is absolutely everything else that has been crammed into this box. Castles of Mad King Ludwig used to fit on my shelf at a quarter of a Cadillac shelf,
Jen,
or maybe
it
even
still
less
does.
Than that.
This game just isn't for you. That's okay.
No, they haven't
stopped making the original.
Consistent,
which I agree. So, okay, here's the thing with Castles of Mad King Ludwig. This is a very simple game. At the end of the day, it is a very simple game, straightforward, but it's fun. Now I'm seeing glass bead discs. I'm seeing miniatures the size of almost the size of the height of the actual box. I'm seeing 3D printed inserts on a super long board where I've never even needed that in the initial game. And it just begs the question, when are these things actually necessary, and what is being done to improve my game experience versus just kind of, I don't know, falling into the traps of Kickstarter?
Jen, I think you're confusing the concept of function over more than so. A Rolex doesn't tell time. A Rolex is an experience that goes on your wrist. That's kind of where I run out of analogies. Maybe an Aston Martin. An Aston Martin doesn't get you from place to place. An Aston Martin is an experience.
But do I need an experience with Castles of Mad King Ludwig?
That's your choice. And if the answer is no, don't back it.
Can I get my 2 cents in here, please? Eres reasonable y guapo.
I'm reasonable and handsome?
See?
Jen, if you don't need an Aston Martin, you don't buy one. You don't rally against the creation of said Aston Martin.
But here's the issue. If I had an option, let's say that I am a fan of Castles of Mad King Ludwig, I'm not sure that the things that they're offering in this collector's edition are going to be available later on. I don't, like, maybe it's in the page that I just haven't seen it, but it's a type of, I don't know, it's like locking out.
Should we stop
content.
The creation of all luxury goods, lest people who don't want them are not
Probably.
Willing to get them and don't want to be tempted?
For me, I think there's a very fine line between what luxury should probably be in this hobby, or at least I feel there should be a little bit more options,
Jen,
in Kickstarter when that happens.
This entire hobby is luxury.
No, okay, sure. I hear that, but it doesn't have to go this hard, is what I'm saying.
You know what? Guys, wait. I think I saw this. I am proposing right here. We can start this. We are all in the content creation space. We can be part of this voice. I am proposing a limit of 15 new games that can come out each year. We'll vote. We'll figure it out. 15 new games per year, one of which is allowed to be deluxified. And that's it. There's enough games out there. We don't need more.
Okay. So I think there's a very different conversation here, because a lot of the games that we get to play them because we are content creators. But I am talking from the side of the consumer. To me, the deluxification of games has created a huge barrier to entry for people that just want to play a game. For years.
All right. You're not going to win. I entered this hobby on a $400 base game.
Yes, exactly. Sure. But that wasn't the case for me, man. I remember when I used to get games like this for $30, $50, $60, and I didn't have to worry about these ridiculous components. I didn't have to worry about gigantic boxes that basically took my entire house.
Jen, just to be clear, you're proposing that this should be... You want Castle Mad King Ludwig to be more accessible to people, right?
It is.
It is already accessible. No, I understand that.
That's what you want, right? You want it to be available for cheaper, so people can jump into the hobby, get something easier, cheaper, and just have an easier time, right? What better way to do that than to put out 10,000 copies of a deluxe version, of which most of those people have the original and now need to get rid of it for cheap?
I like what they did here, and I'm sad that it just can't be re-implemented into the base copy. I'm assuming that maybe it's going to happen. I really hope that they continue that artwork. I just don't see how the miniatures add to the experience. I don't see how this gigantic board adds to the experience. I don't see how these 3D trays adds to the experience.
Whoa. No. You had me with the towers. Yeah, you had me with the gigantic board. The 3D trays...
Of course they add to the experience.
Oh, maybe. I don't know. It's just, it feels
so... It's less time setting up and more time playing,
and
Jan.
Let's
That's
just be 100% clear, Jan.
It just feels
At
overwrought.
The end of the day, miniatures sell. They sell on Kickstarter.
I hate it.
Well, but it doesn't matter. I mean, good business is good business. And I understand your... pushback for the commoditization of our industry, but at the end of the day, we are a hobby industry. You don't have to own every single game that comes out. If I love a game, if I loved Castles of Mad King, let's say a game that I really love, Dale of Merchants, came out with a upgraded, beautiful, incredible version of it, I'm gonna be there. I just am. I just covered Ticket to Ride, not because I'm necessarily buying that new 15th anniversary edition, but because some people, including members of my family who love that game as a grail family game, they want that upgraded experience.
My worry is, Jesse, and this is a trend that I've been seeing, is that even the standard copy of the game is going to be just deluxified to no end. Making everything prohibitively expensive and continuing to make like the lowest tier of a game in Kickstarter or in retail, whatever. Like, for example, Bezier Games in particular are doing that. Their latest Whistle Mountain is easily $80. Maglev Metro is going to be $80 as well. Every single game that I'm seeing on Kickstarter in the last few months is over $80 as well. It drives me crazy.
No, I understand in terms of free cash and what you actually have to invest in the hobby, but the hobby is a hobby at the end of the day, and some things will be prohibitively expensive. Here's the question that I'm willing to pose. Is the price of the game based off of extra components, glass beads, miniatures, all those fancy things? Or are those fancy things included because effective marketing allows the price of the game to scale to a point where more people can purchase it? If you put out a game that is $20, you know, to purchase, that doesn't have the things that effectively market and sell it, your company very well may not do great on Kickstarter. There is a marketplace that exists. There's communities that are willing to purchase these things. And let's be honest, the most expensive part of a game is game development and design in itself. It's not the 3D miniatures that you add on because people will pay extra for them. You're seeing the increase in price based off of those extra components, when the reality of it is the cost of a game being produced is expensive in its own right. And so those 3D components help it sell better so more games can be made.
I understand all of that. I just I just, it deters me from delving deeper into the side of the hobby, honestly. Lately, I've been more and more averse to backing anything on Kickstarter exactly because of that. Because of those marketing tactics, because it always works, because people always want the same thing.
But
I'm just kind of disappointed, honestly.
Half of your shelf would not exist if it wasn't for crowdfunding platforms.
Actually, that is not true. I've noticed that I rarely keep Kickstarter games. Sincerely, most of my games are actually.
Then you should stop backing them. That's not a problem.
No. Exactly. And I think that's what I've been learning.
I will rephrase that then. Half of my top 10 list won't exist without Kickstarter.
Sure. And Kickstarter is a beautiful thing. I just honestly, and I don't know if many people agree with me. I don't know how much I like the trend that we're going and that we're moving into, because it is bleeding into the publisher side as well now, into the normal retail market, and that worries me.
My top 10 games of all time, in order, from 10 down to 1, is going to be Vindication, a Kickstarter game, Rouge, Food Chain Magnets, Cyclades, and Coimbra, all non-Kickstarter games, Zombicide Black Plague, Cthulhu Death May Die, Kickstarter games, Innocent Terraforming Mars not, and Blood Rage yes. So it looks like I am 4 for 10 out of Kickstarter games in my top 10.
I am all for Kickstarter. I love the platform and I love the creativity that it brings. I just wish that it went back again into celebrating innovation and mechanics versus statuettes that I can just present and make look pretty.
Pay attention to other things then, because many games do.
Dwellings of Eldervale is one, actually, that I absolutely hated the miniature implementation in that.
Well, that's a conversation we're going to have on another episode. And with that,
is that the sitcom?
This is the ending of the show. We're going to answer some critical comments soon. And if you liked what we've done so far, leave a 5-star rating on any of your listening platforms.
Yeah. Alex, take it away.
Welcome to Jen and Jesse. They just don't like fun.
This latest failed attempt at bringing you quality entertainment was brought to you by the Quackalope Podcast. We love to hear from you, so don't forget to leave a review and subscribe. If you'd like to connect with us, follow us on any of our social channels or visit our website. But regardless of what you do, remember to do the important thing. Get out and play some games. Until next time.
And with that being said, let's go ahead and go through some listener comments. If you have tuned into the show to this point, that means you don't mind weird mid-segment arguments. You're not concerned with stumbling over words. And for some reason, you enjoy the product that we're putting out. And if that is the case, you can connect with us in two very specific regions. First off, leave a comment over on theweeklyquack.com. letting us know your thoughts and leaving a question that we might answer in a future episode, and swing over to our Facebook group, a community of about 800 members at this point that all like to engage in the same debates we're having here. That'll be facebook.com, search for the Quackalope Podcast.
And if you didn't know, we also now have a Board Game Geek Guild that you can search by looking for the Quackalope Podcast on Board Game Geek. We're looking for new members. It'd be awesome to have you there. And with that, I'm going to go ahead and bring in my question of the day. This is going to be from Quacks. Very straightforward. What is the game that you most want to play in 2021?
Oldsworn.
Yeah, it's a toughie. It's a toughie.
No, it's not
tough. You already played it.
Okay. Fine. Cadium, the big black box that is going to be arriving.
The Gambler's Chest.
Yes, the Gambler's Chest.
Is Primal the Awakening landing in 2021? Because I'll
pick
that.
No way.
Nope, it's not. There's no way it is.
No, so then...
Yeah, there's no way. Man.
So many good games.
I mean, Townsfolk Tussle.
Possibly Massive Darkness. Possibly.
Massive Darkness, really?
He hasn't played Massive Darkness 2 yet.
I haven't played it yet. So like when I'm weighing up the temptation about a game that I really want to play that I'm waiting for versus something that I already know I like that I want to get back to the table, like Endless Winter or even Dead Reckoning or any of those, possibly Massive Darkness. It's very up there, that's for sure.
So for me, I'm currently looking through all my like the games I've kickstarted, surprisingly.
Oh, you should skip that list entirely because you don't like Kickstarters.
Yeah,
Jen.
You don't like Kickstarters.
I never said that. I said deluxified things. Yep. I don't love.
You said when there you look goes, at your shelf, you rarely keep Kickstarters. They mostly leave
all
your collection.
Future Kickstarter
sure.
contracts.
Doesn't mean that I'm not excited to try them. So,
I mean, I think it's worth mentioning, like for instance, a game like Primal the Awakening, which is completely overpriced and expensive for all the content you're getting. I mean, you're getting it's $300 for a handful of miniatures and boss fights. That would be a classic example of the over-deluxification of Kickstarter that Jen would never want to add to his collection.
I agree with you, actually, but I really like the game. So I still want to try it at the very least, but I agree with you that there is a little bit in there that is going with my new favorite word of the day, gratuitous. 100%.
Can you describe what this sound is?
Sounds like chips. Are those chips?
Yeah, poker chips.
Yes, I hear you. I like poker chips. Alex is trying to do ASMR, but I don't think he's being successful like Jesse is.
No, he's failing.
No, I'm not very good at the ASMR.
So, the games that I'm really looking forward to this year, Merchant's Cove is at the very tippy top of that. Very excited for Merchant's Cove from Final Frontier Games.
I forgot that
was
coming out this year.
Well, I hope so. It does seem like it is. I've seen production copies already. We should be getting that hopefully before summer. The next one is going to be one of my favorite games, Millennium Blades, the new expansion that's going to basically streamline a lot of the elements.
Do you even play the game?
No, here's but it doesn't thing. Mean I don't
Jen,
love it.
Here's what I'll promise you. When we move in together, we'll start playing Millennium Blades together.
But here's the thing, Jesse. I don't want to play it until I have Collusion, because Collusion fixes a lot of the initial setup that I absolutely hate about Millennium Blades.
I currently own all of Millennium Blades except two of the expansions that were completely sold out, and it is unopened in my closet.
Interesting. The other one... Let's see that I am very excited about is going to be Wild Ascent. I believe that's coming out this year.
Yeah, I'm excited for that one.
I've heard from Jeremy Howard that the game, because I've been very doubtful if Lazy Squire, is going to come up with a really strong showing from the onset. Jeremy Howard told me that this is going to be absolutely fantastic. He's played it and he was very surprised how strong it was.
He also liked Primal though.
And Alex did too, sir. And Primal, I'm sure I'm going to love it. And I will say it on this podcast as soon as I actually play it. Merchants of the Dark Road, isn't that coming up this year?
It is.
Yeah, Merchants of the Dark Road, man. There's a lot here. And one that we've never talked about that kind of came on my radar very late in the process, but I definitely backed it in time, is called Magnate the First City. That one's one that you'll probably going to have to look for. I think it has a lot of potential to be absolutely amazing. Let me see if I can give you a really quick synopsis of this here. Midway strategy, auction bidding, dice rolling, modular boards, push your luck a little bit.
Reading words.
Yeah, I remember that it was a city building game with auctioning inside of it that you could, practically build the entire city with miniatures, with everything. It looked beautiful on the board. I'm excited to try it out. It's actually from a new publisher, so it is a risky endeavor, but I heard really good things during the process of it, so I'm definitely super excited about it. So I don't know. Those are a few 2021 games right there. We're probably missing a lot of them that are coming out very recently, but hey, let us know what your top 10 most anticipated or your top most anticipated game for 2021 is going to be.
And I believe he had one more question, which was tea or coffee.
Oh, you're right. 100% coffee.
What are you talking about?
Coffee. It's not even a remote
good
question.
Herbal tea.
What the
are you
hell?
Kidding me?
No tea.
Oh,
so
my gosh.
In the immortal words of Ted Lasso, tea is just flavored brown water, and it is horrible.
Oh, well, are you kidding me?
To be fair, coffee is flavored brown water, and it's delicious.
And let's be 100% accurate. Tea is delicious across the board. Coffee gives you acid reflux early in the morning.
That sounds like a you problem.
Jesse, you need to introduce yourself to cold brew.
No, I've tried cold brew. It makes me more anxious than I normally am, which isn't very often, but over the last month has been very, very anxious for some reason. Tea is lovely. Tea is like my daily drink throughout the winter. I absolutely love a good herbal fruit-based tea.
So just to be clear, Jesse, you're saying you really hate coffee.
I like coffee-ish. I like coffee with cream and sugar. I like coffee. I like cold brew with caramel syrup poured within it. I'm not a big coffee fan. No, coffee's okay. But anyone that likes probably.
And Jen, you don't like tea.
No, I've never been a big fan of it. But I will
Jen
say that
and
when
Jesse,
I do,
they don't like fun.
Alex, I think you have a question. Can you bring your question, please?
Sure. And this is going to be another question from Eric W. Eric, thank you for continuously showing up in the comments. You
know,
Eric's
some
people
awesome.
Would think that we don't have people listening. We have dedicated, hardcore listeners
we
every
have
single week.
Three.
And yet, they don't always go and post their questions at theweeklyquack.com.
I don't understand
which you really should. This is what we'll answer. There's only like three comments a week. We will. I mean, they can be wrong. We have a very active Facebook community, which is amazingly fun.
Oh, yeah.
But if you want a question answered,
well,
I digress.
And statistically, we have close to 1,000 listeners a week, which is incredible. But we'd like to hear from you.
Yeah, we'd like to hear from you. And so with that, Eric W., again, a question for Eric W. When the two of you become Alex's neighbors, which isn't currently happening, but we'll work on that.
So close. So close.
So close. But which game would we play? Which of the games would we play together first?
Tainted Grail.
Wow. What? Really? Tainted Grail would be the first game that you would play in a three-player setting.
And Jan's would be Unicorn Fever. Okay, great.
I just got everything in.
Oh, did
you? Oh, that's true. So did I.
Yeah.
Oh my God, so many boxes.
Let me answer honestly, with a three-player setting, what game with Jan, Alex, because we've actually, all three of us have never been in the same environment, I don't believe.
Unfortunately.
Nope, not yet.
And so what game would I want to get to the table with all three of us from the very first showing?
I know what I would say.
Either Blood Rage or Cthulhu Death May Die.
Huh. Great choices, actually. Blood Rage would be amazing.
Yeah, all
with the
those
three
are solid. I was thinking Terraforming Mars.
It was
I'm
on the
thinking,
list.
I'm thinking Chinatown would be an absolute
riot
of a game.
Oh, no, you need more than three. You need four minimum, ideally five.
I'm thinking only three, Jan.
Okay, fine. It's just, I think that us three in that game.
Unicorn Fever it is.
You know what? I'm going to go with my classic. I'm going to go with Brass Birmingham.
Ooh, I would love to play that one. That's great at three.
It is a shame we will never be near each other.
Ever, ever, ever.
Stop it, Jesse. It's totally going to happen. You'll see. We have to make this we have to get Alex in a booth to record our sitcom, and it's going to happen.
Jen and Jesse, they don't like fun.